by Ratio Architects, designers and planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Granite Center for the Performing Arts. The 2005-2006 schedule of music, dance, opera, and theatrical events at Granite Center is available by contacting the Granite Center Ticket Office at 217-333-6280 or 800-KCPATIX, 800-527-2849. Information is also available on the web at granitecenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll talk about reducing crime while at the same time building community support for policing. Our guest is David Harris. He is Bach Professor of Law and Values at the University of Toledo College of Law, an authority on racial profiling. He is the author of a new book on preventing crime. The title, Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. David Harris spent 5 years researching this book. His research led him to look at police departments across the U.S., including Chicago, New York, Detroit, Los Angeles, and San Diego. And in the book, he argues against what he calls Ashcroft policing. He says we need not sacrifice constitutional rights for security. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, David Harris. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. In addition to his new book, Good Cops, David Harris is the author of Profiles in Injustice, Why Racial Profiling Cannot Work. Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing is published by The New Press. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor Harris, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You say the initiatives of the Patriot Act that were designed to alter the role of local police forces could make safety and security against terrorism more difficult to achieve. In regard to local policing and the war on terror, what was the objective of the Ashcroft Department of Justice?
Well, the Ashcroft Department of Justice seemed to have as its goals not only doing things that would make the country safer from terrorism, clearly that was its task, but instilling a kind of attitude as to what was acceptable and what you could say about the government and so forth, things that I found profoundly disturbing. The mistake, though, that they made with police and safety and terrorism was, if anything, more serious. What they did was, instead of consulting local and state police, who are the people closest to the ground, who know the populations of our cities and towns the best, and who particularly might know immigrant populations and groups and leaders from Middle Eastern groups, from immigrants from the Muslim world, what they did was they ignored local police and set up kind of old-style dragnet policing. And, of course, I don't mean the old TV show. I mean this sort of technique where you just go out and you pick lots of people up, hundreds of them in the wake of September 11th. You hold them on whatever you can, generally immigration charges, and you just see if they've been involved in anything, and then you have to deport them. And they did this over and over and over to hundreds of people, as the inspector general of their own department found. And then on top of it, used techniques that targeted the Arab American, Middle Eastern, and Muslim populations in our country, such as the interviews of 5,000 young men from the Middle East, such as the registration systems that had been put into place and have now been scrapped. The net result of this is to alienate those very groups from government, from police. Now, you know, you can take that in terms of bruised feelings. You can take it all kinds of ways. What I mean when I say alienate them, if you're going to collect intelligence on potential sleeper cells made up of Middle Eastern people, let's say, the government tells us they're out there, you need intelligence from the Middle Eastern communities. There's simply no alternative. And by targeting those very populations, the Ashcroft Justice Department did this country a profound disservice just in terms of our own self-interest, because it instills fears in that community. When people fear the police, they don't come forward, they don't give information, and it really hurts our ability to collect and use valuable intelligence.
Yeah. Now, there were some communities where the police department says, no, we can't handle it this way. We've got to do something differently. So did the Justice Department take notice of that? Did they listen to the chiefs? What was the department's response to the refusal?
Well, unfortunately, they did not listen. The Department of Justice, of course, has its own police department, if you will, the FBI, and it tasked its agents to go out in the field, and for instance, with the 5,000 and then another 3,000 interviews, the FBI agents had no choice but to go out and follow the Attorney General's order and get those interviews done, as silly as the interviews themselves were, and as damaging as they were. If the Department of Justice had listened to local police, they would have known that the last thing that communities want is federal officers tramping in there, especially with threats that they might use immigration law against people. And it just absolutely destroys the sort of conduit of information that is so valuable to us right now. If people fear, they don't come forward. It's as simple as that. And it's very unfortunate indeed that the Justice Department did not listen to local police. They're the ones who police those communities every single day of the year. They know how to communicate with the people. They have the contacts. And instead, their objections were ignored.
I want to talk about a couple of cities that did things a little differently, namely Detroit and Chicago. I want to do that in a little bit, but I want to lay some more groundwork here at the beginning of the program. John Ashcroft has now been succeeded by Alberto Gonzalez. Has he changed the course set by his predecessor?
I'd have to say, with Mr. Gonzalez just coming out of his first 6 months as Attorney General, I don't see much difference. He's a sort of kinder, gentler character. I think everybody can see that. He has made a practice of meeting with the long-term staff of the department, the people that make up the backbone of the federal law enforcement effort, in a way that Attorney General Ashcroft never did. And he seems to have at least made some effort to depoliticize some of the things that the department is doing. But, you know, in his major speeches, especially the first one he made after taking office after Ashcroft, Alberto Gonzalez basically reaffirmed all the major policy initiatives of the Justice Department from the Patriot Act on down. I see no evidence that in substance the approach of the Justice Department is going to change any. And that's really a shame, because there's a lot they can learn from local police, and I still see no evidence that they're even willing to consider it.
Mm. Well, the Patriot Act is now 4 years old. Has it, in fact, changed the practices of local police forces?
It hasn't really changed the practices of local police forces. The Patriot Act as a law, and it's a sprawling monster of a law that changes lots and lots of things all over the federal criminal code, really has its biggest impact on federal law enforcement. It gives the FBI a lot more power to do things it has basically wanted to do for years, been on its wish list for a long time, but they just never were able to persuade Congress to give them these additional powers until after September 11th, 2001. So it hasn't changed what local police do. Other aspects of Homeland Security and anti-terrorism defense have changed some things that local police do. They're forced to spend a lot of their resources protecting large public events. They spend a lot of resources inspecting infrastructure and protecting infrastructure. Those are just things that we're going to have to get used to in this country. Our local police departments and public safety outfits having to budget a lot of their resources for those tasks. But that's really not the Patriot Act. The real dangers of the Patriot Act are at the federal level, and that's more bothersome, frankly, than if it was local law enforcement, because at least with local law enforcement, I have some feeling I can get some accountability out of them. It may not be easy, but if I'm really upset about something my local police are doing, I can, I can talk to the chief, I can go to my councilmen, something like that. The federal government and the FBI and the Justice Department are really more or less impervious to most criticism from any kind of a local citizen point of view, and I think that's very disturbing. When we look at the Patriot Act, what we see is a statute that has basically changed lots of the basics of our systems in some very important ways. Checks and balances, the balance of power, giving more power to the executive unchecked. And now, of course, Congress is right in the midst of considering whether to renew the sunsetting provisions in the law. And there's disagreement about what they're going to do, but it certainly looks like they're going to renew most of it. I think this is a real alarm bell for Americans, and I don't think it should go unnoticed.
Mm. Preventive policing, obviously, it's all about preventing crime. We can talk more about specifics as we go along, but would you give us an overview of the principles of preventive policing?
Oh, sure. When we talk about preventive policing, we're drawing together some aspects of innovations in policing over the last 20, 30 years, like community policing, like problem-oriented policing, and we're placing them into the larger context of prevention along with some other ideas. So the core concepts you're thinking of when you talk about prevention, how do you accomplish it? Number one, you look to build bridges with your community. You look to have partnerships and real relationships with your community. I don't mean public relations. I mean relationships of true partners where decisions are made together, jointly by the police department and the communities that they serve, where they decide on priorities together, where they decide on strategies together. Number two, we look at problem solving. Instead of just responding to each individual crime as if it is a discrete incident and looking to solve that crime, all of which are appropriate, problem solving takes us to the next level. Instead of just looking at the individual incidents, we look for the pattern of incidents. And we say, not just why did the shooting take place outside this liquor store, why are there so many shootings and assaults over the last 6 or 8 or 10 months in front of this place, and what can we do about it to get 911 calls down, and more down? The idea, again, is to prevent the damage from occurring in the future, not just to respond to it, not to be on that 911 response treadmill. From there, we talk about accountability. Accountability is one of the key aspects of prevention because police must be accountable to the public and they have to be internally accountable to their own commands, to their command structures, that is, to their policies and so forth. If we have real accountability through things like citizens' boards, through things like inspector generals and auditors, through things like early warning systems, we can get to the problems in police organizations themselves and prevent those problems from becoming public catastrophes. For instance, if we're shooting too many unarmed people, as apparently was happening in Cincinnati and some other American communities in the late 90s, we can address that problem by finding the evidence for it and fixing it before our community explodes in a riot. Segments 4 and 5 sort of go together. We're talking about leadership, Leadership has changed in policing. There are an increasing number of police leaders willing to do radical things like giving up their own power instead of accumulating it, giving it to their lieutenants and their captains, and giving that to them and saying, you fix things, you're accountable for it, here's the power to do it. That's a very unusual thing in policing. And then last but not least, changing police culture. Changing police culture is probably the toughest thing to do of all. That has to be accomplished through long-term efforts where we insist on the way policing has been done for years. We insist on that changing. We apply pressure to organizations over a long period of time so that the culture becomes one in law enforcement that is identified with the good officers, the officers with real ethics, with real standards, and not the very few bad officers. So those are the five principles that bring prevention into focus. Building bridges, problem solving, accountability, leadership, and changing culture.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, David Harris. He's a professor of law and values at the University of Toledo. He is the author of Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering, my understanding was that the Patriot Act was sold as a means to prevent terrorism. And what I've been hearing is that when federal agents use their broad powers for surveillance and search and seizures under the Patriot Act, that even though they don't find terrorism, that they are able to prosecute drug and other crimes under the Patriot Act's allowance for all the search and seizure and unusual powers that they have to, collect evidence that wouldn't be ordinarily given to them under normal state statutes. Also, my second question is, under preventive policing, do you see citizen review boards as part of the component toward better law enforcement? And I'll hang up and listen.
That's a great set of questions. On the Patriot Act, the listener's really put his finger on something very, very important. The act was sold as an absolute emergency necessity, something that Congress had to do, you remember, just weeks after the 9/11 attacks, on the specific premise that we need these tools now to fight terrorism. There is simply no substitute, and that the tools would not be used for anything else. In other words, realizing that these new tactics that the law would allow, that they stretched pretty far, and they would maybe be the kinds of things we wouldn't normally grant under regular circumstances for the terrorism struggle, we had to give them to the government. Well, two very interesting things have happened. Number one is what the caller said. The government is now using these powers to fight regular garden variety crimes, to take down, a strip club in Las Vegas. That was one that I read about. To do any number of other kinds of regular investigations. Now, the Justice Department has made this, a big point of pride. Hey, look what we're able to do with these new tools. But if the caller correctly points out, we were sold a bill of goods. We wouldn't have granted these powers had it not been for the emergency and the promise that they would only be used that way. Now, here's another interesting little side of it, though. It turns out, we now know, through things like the 9/11 Commission report, the problem was not that the FBI and whoever else did not have the powers they needed to fight off the terrorists. It's, in fact, they had too much information to start with. They weren't handling the information and intelligence they were getting, let alone needing new powers to gather more. So the whole thing was sold to us, I would argue, on a faulty premise. As to the other part of the caller's question, what about citizen review boards? That's definitely something I discussed in the context of accountability for preventive policing. Citizen review boards are an important idea. The concept, of course, is that the police department is part of a democratic system. It has to be accountable to citizens, and citizens should have somewhere to go and voice complaints when they feel that they have not been treated correctly by police. Now, of course, you can always complain to the police department, but the thought always was, you know, who's guarding the guardians? Are they going to take complaints seriously against them? I have a lot of friends in policing, but I have to say the record of police departments in general at responding to complaints against themselves and their own officers has not been good. And that's where the concept of citizens review came from, that citizens had to have an independent review, independent of the police department. One thing you'll learn if you study this stuff, and I've talked a lot about this in Good Cops, there are now many different mechanisms for ensuring police accountability. Citizen review boards are one, but there are many others now. And we've got 30 years of experience with citizen review boards. What we find is kind of discouraging. Their records are, you know, mixed at best. Some of them have worked. Many of them have not, because they've not been given the tools, the subpoena power, the budget, the staff to really do the job. And they end up kind of just withering and dying. And you can actually argue pretty well that it's worse to have a crippled board than none at all. The model that I advocate and have talked about a lot is to install an auditor in a police department or over a police department. The auditor would not so much take complaints about individual incidents as look at the systems in the department overall. In other words, study the complaint review system within the police department, study the policies within the police department, and make recommendations. This is a system that's rather new, and it's worked very well in a number of American cities.
Do police departments now have someone on the force who is a liaison or an ombudsman who sort of is a mediator, a go-between between the public and the force?
Generally, no. I mean, there's no person whose official job it is to do that. One of the very attractive ideas of community policing, which is easily the most important innovation in American policing in the last 40 years, is that the whole force should understand, not by way of a set of tactics or meetings, but as a philosophy, that every person in the force, from the chief down to every patrol person, they're all tasked with meeting and talking to and knowing the public. Now, having said that, you'd have to acknowledge, I think, that it doesn't happen as often as anybody would like. And some forces have designated liaisons to particular communities. And it has worked out very well. For instance, the Seattle Police Department, they now have liaisons in place for any number of different groups within their cities, the relatively new African immigrant community, Asian community, Chinese community, gay, lesbian, transgendered community. All these communities, they sort of formed boards or community advisory committees, and every one of them has a police officer as an advisory liaison. This person can get them right through all the departmental red tape, right directly up to an assistant chief. So if somebody who's a part of the advisory group of citizens has a complaint or a suggestion or a question, or a request, that can get to a very high level in a department very, very easily. But ideally what you want is you want things to be, you want the department to be approachable by anybody. That's the model, and hopefully more police departments will approach that ideal.
Hmm. One example you cite of preventive policing successes comes from Chicago, and it involves the end of a murder spree that began near an Orthodox synagogue in Rogers Park.
Yes.
Actually affected this community as well.
Yes, indeed it did.
A Chicago police sergeant by the name of Anthony Scalise was able to get a lead on the suspect, Benjamin Smith, right after that shooting spree that began, near the synagogue in Rogers Park. Tell us the story.
Yes. Oh, this is a fantastic example. Scalise, who is still, as far as I know, with the Chicago PD, He was made head of the hate crimes unit in the Civil Rights Office of the Police Department in the early 90s. Now, this was a new concept then. I think we all sort of know what hate crimes, what that means now, the idea that certain crimes are more serious if they're carried out for reasons of racial or ethnic bias. This was a new idea, but he took it very seriously, and he immediately did the work of building bridges into each and every minority community in Chicago. And not just maybe the ones that occur to us first, the African-American community. Of course, he went to the various Latino communities in Chicago. Of course, it's a very diverse group of communities, some from Puerto Rico and some from the DR and some from other places, but into some newer communities too. All over the city, he carried the same message. We want to work with you. We're not going to stand for hate crimes. If you're getting harassment, if you're getting vandalism, no matter what it is, we want to know about it. Talk to us. We'll be your partners, and we're going to control this in our city. We're not going to put up with it. And over the course of many years, Scalise worked with all these communities. When they called him, he was there. Even when they didn't call him, he was there at their meetings. He was there to show and to act as a partner. And this was very important in gaining community confidence over many years. Well, finally, we come to this terrible day. It's July 4th weekend of 1999, and Scalise gets a call, and he's told to get up to the Rogers Park neighborhood in Chicago as fast as he can. And as soon as he arrives, he realizes why he was called, because he looks around the scene. There's been a shooting, a multiple victim shooting, and he sees every one of the victims appear from their dress to be Orthodox Jews. They all seem to have been shot when they're out on foot on their way to synagogue on Friday night of that weekend. And this is just, you know, your absolute worst fear if you're in charge of hate crimes. This looks like a multiple hate crime involving firearms. And so he's glad he's there, but one of his officers comes up to him and tells him they've got a problem. None of the victims will talk to him. None of the victims will talk to the police. Why not? Well, Scalise knows this. He understands right away, because the victims are Orthodox Jews. He's worked with their community, among many, many others, and he knows that on Friday night, which is the Jewish Sabbath, no member of that community is going to do anything that might be construed as work. And talking to municipal officials or police officers, that looks enough like work that people just won't do it. It's keep the Sabbath holy is among the most important commandments in the Jewish religion. And so none of these victims would talk to Scalise or his men, and they would not be able to do so for 24 hours till the end of the Sabbath on Saturday night. While he's standing there and all this is coming in on him, they get radio calls. There's been another shooting. This time it's in the nearby suburban community of Skokie, a heavily Jewish area. This time the victim is not a Jew, but a black man who was out walking around near his house, who lived in that community. That victim died. And then just 20 minutes after that, another set of radio calls. There's been another set of shootings, this time in a community just a little bit further out called Northbrook, also a Jewish area. It happens that these victims are all Asian. They're outside. Whoever the shooter is has seen Asian people and shot at them. Thank God none of them were seriously wounded. And so this is your worst, worst nightmare. It looks like a serial hate crime is taking place. And no information is available. What is he going to do? Well, Scalise didn't know how to solve his problem, but he knew who to talk to about it because of his long work with the Jewish community in that very area. It's a heavily Jewish area, Rogers Park. He knew who to call. He called a guy named Moshe Wolf. Moshe Wolf had been his partner in that community, an Orthodox Jew himself, a rabbi, a chaplain with the Chicago Police Department. Scalise went to his house, found him, said, you know, I've got a problem. Describe the problem. Says, can you help me? I don't know what to do. And Rabbi Wolf says, I'm on it. And off he goes to meet with the victims, right down to the 24th District Police Station there in Rogers Park, goes directly, and he takes the first of them, who is in shape to talk, and explains to the victim an important concept in Judaism, bekuach nefesh. I may be getting the pronunciation off a little, but that's what it is. Bekuach nefesh, this means a matter of life and death. When you got a matter of life and death, you can disregard even the strictures of the Sabbath to address the matter of life and death. And this, Rabbi Wolf explained to the victim, this was one of those situations. You need to talk to the police and tell them what you saw. And the man, having talked to Rabbi Wolf, he was ready to talk to the police. He went right to him. He said, here's what I saw. I saw a man in a car, single person in a car. Here's a fragmentary description of the car. Gives a description of this of the shooter. These descriptions, this important clue was matched up with some of the other information from Skokie and Northbrook. And for the first time, all the law enforcement agencies involved had some information to go on. They knew they were dealing with one shooter, one vehicle, and they had an idea what it looked like, and this put them on the trail of this killer that, as you said, led actually downstate into Indiana and into Illinois, and they finally did track the killer down.
I remember that so
vividly. Yeah, I mean, it's
so
just one of those things where if you don't have the partnerships, if you haven't built the bridges, that never happens. So you don't know always what you're going to prevent when you do preventive policing. You can't imagine what use it'll come to, perhaps, but it can do things for you in situations that you never dreamed of.
Does it have its critics? What are their objections? Do they have a point?
Well, the criticism I hear most often is that this is some kind of touchy-feely program, that it is not, quote-unquote, real policing, that real policing is about running out and getting the bad guys off the street. We just don't have the resources to task people with problem solving, to get them out there building the bridges. That takes people away from real police work, which is answering citizens' calls for help and finding bad guys and putting drug dealers in jail. They have a point, but only a small one, I'd put it that way. Every police officer I talk to, every chief I talk to, everybody all up and down, there is a surprising degree of acceptance of the idea that every crime you can prevent, that's just less work for the rest of the police force to do. That's just fewer people who get arrested. It's fewer people who turn into repeat offenders. The most important comments I remember hearing are in some programs I wrote about involving kids, a summer camp that was set up by a police department and that resulted in crimes by juveniles falling precipitously over several years. The police chief who'd been involved in that said, every kid we're helping is somebody we won't have to arrest later. Better to intervene when they're young than later. There is a coalition of law enforcement agencies out in the American West, all supporting an initiative in California to make mandatory, I said that wrong, to have universally available preschool. Now, why would police chiefs be about universal preschool? Because they know that for every dollar they spend, that society spends in something like a preschool program or a literacy program, it saves them $2 and more in later enforcement costs. And you just can't emphasize strongly enough that this is real police work. It has a different feel than what we think about or what we see on TV, but the people engaged in it, they know, they prove it every day. This is the way of the future.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, David Harris, the author of Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. That's what we're talking about here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine, reducing crime, preventing crime, and building community support for policing. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We mentioned earlier the importance of a vocal citizenry and the Citizen Review Board. What about the role of community groups, of citizen advocates and activists? And maybe we could talk here about a Detroit woman by the name of Deidre McGee.
Yeah, the role of citizens and advocates in communities could not be more important to the success of preventive policing. You know, we're accustomed to seeing a kind of us versus them, citizens versus police kind of setup in a lot of discussions about law enforcement. And it's very, very unfortunate. And I have to say there's enough blame in some of these things to go a long way on both sides. While I've done most of my work with citizens and advocacy groups, you know, police want the support of communities too. So the Detroit example is a great story of how this can happen in a way that benefits everybody. Deidre McGee worked for NCCJ, that's the National Council of Community and Justice, has a big chapter in Detroit. And when the issue of racial profiling was very prominent in the public discussion in the late 90s, she came forward with an idea. She wanted to set up a leadership group. The idea would be to have leaders of law enforcement and citizens advocacy groups come together to try to discuss and address the idea and the problem of racial profiling. Now, there was a lot of disagreement about what that actually meant, racial profiling, but everybody agreed that it was important that law enforcement and citizens have each other's trust. In other words, that they be partners. And everybody also agreed that having this concept out there, having the idea out there, the belief, the perception that profiling was going on, that was damaging to the creation of trust between law enforcement and the community. So that's what they built this group around, the concept that trust was important and should be nurtured. Well, here's what happened. McGee brought together leaders of the United States Attorney's Office, the local FBI field office, some of the local police departments like Dearborn and some other places, and she brought together some of the heads of the prominent citizen activist groups like the NAACP, like the ACLU, like some Arab American groups, remembering that Detroit and Dearborn have the largest Arab American communities in the country. Now, they didn't agree. I'll tell you the truth. I was at some of these meetings early on. They did not agree, even about the definition of profiling. But what they agreed upon was that it was the importance of the group itself, and McGee understood this, the importance of trust and the importance of building that trust through the group. And they continued to meet even though they argued, but they became partners for each other. And McGee had an ingenious idea. She said, well, all right, let's put together a conference, a citywide, a metropolitan area conference on profiling. It doesn't mean we have to agree, but let's work toward this. And she knew that just doing the work of creating the conference a year or more in advance, that that would bring people together. And sure enough, it really did. Over the course of that year, these people who worked together became real partners. They became sources for each other when there was a community crisis. I talked to the head of the NAACP office there. What he told me was, you know, now when there's a rumor about the police treating somebody poorly or shooting somebody, I can pick up the phone and I can call the chief in that town, or I can call the chief in the next town over who I know from the group, and they'll tell me, no, here's the real deal, and I can get the information out, and we can tamp down these kinds of things before they get out of control. So it was proving to be valuable. They had the conference. It was a big success. But really, the big dividend was the relationships and the bridges being built. And that was really proved after September 11th. This whole organization had been put together well before September 11th, but when September 11th came, everybody knew all of a sudden there was real terror in this community. As I said, Detroit and Dearborn, Michigan, the home of the largest Muslim and Arab American communities in the United States, very old communities from the 1800s, and they knew, what with the attackers being Muslims and people from the Arab world, there was going to be considerable backlash, likely. And the people who had been members of this group, everybody from the FBI to the advocates from the Arab American community, they knew that trouble was ahead. So they met, this group met, just days after the 9/11 attacks, and something really astounding happened. The law enforcement people, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, they came forward and they said, we want to prevent hate crimes in Detroit and Dearborn and all our communities. We want this group to draft a statement that says, we won't tolerate hate crimes. And we want you to report hate crimes. We want the Arab American communities to stand up and say, we're not going to take this. We don't want it to be a secret. We will go after these people and we will stop it. And you can imagine how important it was for law enforcement to come forward with that. And you can imagine the degree of trust it engendered in the Arab community for the FBI to come forward with this idea. And sure enough, they were able to draft a statement and stood together, and it really did help to calm the community in some very, very jittery times. But it was only a month later when something else happened. You recall Ashcroft coming forward with his order to question 5,000 young Arab men. Well, the largest single number of those people were in the Detroit area. And because they had worked together, both the Arab American representatives on this group and the law enforcement people, they knew that if this order was implemented, number one, it would have a heavy impact in their community. Number two, it would cause people to go into a spasm of fear. And everybody understood around that table that this would hurt their ability to collect information and intelligence. So again, they got together and they did something very unusual. In every other city and town in the country, when these interviews were done, FBI agents went around and they basically did cold calls to people's homes, to their businesses, and so forth. And, it, you know, that would be an unnerving thing, I think, to anyone, let alone an Arab American in the wake of 9/11. Yeah. Instead, this group proposed, put together, and got the Justice Department to sign off on a different plan. They sent everybody letters, and they publicized this plan on TV. And the letter said something like this: Dear so-and-so, we'd like to interview you. Here, we at the FBI would like to interview you. You're on this list. You don't have to do it. You can have a lawyer. Here are some names of organizations that will supply you with a lawyer. We can do this at your office, at your home, at our office, wherever you want. You don't have to do it, but we hope we can get your cooperation, sincerely. The end result was that the Detroit area had the highest level of compliance of any city in the country.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I have a listener waiting to talk with us.
Great.
And let's get one more call in before we have to wrap up this afternoon. A listener in Urbana on line one, and we've got about 2-3 minutes left here.
Yeah,
line one, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to point out that this, I'm not sure I can subscribe to what your guest is talking about, mainly because I'm afraid that some police departments would definitely easily drift into like political action, like 2 years ago before the World Agricultural Forum in St. Louis. They did things like condemn a building overnight and then arrest people for occupying a condemned building. They used housing inspections to get around not having a warrant. But I just had a quick question, and that is, I'm afraid that too many of our communities are over invested in police departments. Is there any place you can go where you can do like get comparative information about a community of a certain size and income level, just how big are their police, how many FTE there ought to be in their police department, that kind of thing?
What I'd recommend to the caller is going to the Bureau of Justice Statistics site. It's part of the United States Department of Justice, USDOJ.gov, Bureau of Justice Statistics. Every year they publish a source book, both online and in paper. That information should be available there, or they can direct you to it.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call. One last question here. How common is this approach, preventive policing, across the country today? Because, as the caller alludes to, it's a different situation city to city.
Oh, yes. It's more and more common all the time. More and more police departments and police leaders are seeing that this is the future. I didn't go anywhere where all these principles are in play all the time. I more often saw a department in which one good idea or one good unit or squad was operating, and have highlighted those in the book to give good examples that other departments can follow. But I hear more and more cities and the police departments moving this way. The point is, we can't just criticize police and tell them what not to do. I take a backseat to no one in terms of doing that. I've done plenty of it over the years, particularly on profiling. The object was to give people concrete examples of success on the ground, not theories, but real success that they can implement in their own communities.
Professor Harris, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
David Harris has been our guest this afternoon. He is a professor of law and values at the University of Toledo College of Law. He is the author of Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. He is also the author of Profiles in Injustice, Why Racial Profiling Cannot Work. His new book, Good Cops, is published by The New Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade, I got a kick out of this just now. I asked Dave Dickey what was happening at the board as I'm walking in, because I looked down at the numbers and saw that they were all narrowly mixed across most of the grain floors. And he says, that was a little pathetic. Everybody took a nap for the day. And that's kind of the way things ended up. This is the way futures finished in the bean pit. They were up 1.25 for the nearbys. The far deferred May was up 4 cents, but that was really the only gainer for the day. Across the pits at the Chicago Board of Trade, corn was off a penny to 2 cents for the day. Wheat down one in a nearby contract, that September contract in the wheat pit, trading the soft red winter wheat to a high today of 3.28¾, the low at 3.24. Settlement price there at $3.25. They were down one. December futures at 3.43½, high, low at 3.38¼. Settlement price there at 3.39¾, a penny and 3/4 lower for the day. March contract in the wheat pit, 3.54¾, the high, the low at 51. Settlement price at 52½, and they were down 2. The May contract at 3.61 high, low at 3.58. Settlement price at $3.59, down a penny and a half for the day. July futures 3.65½, the high, the low at 3.62, settlement price at 3.63½, and they were down 1¼. Now the corn pit, September futures 2.26½, the high, low at $2.24, settlement price at 2.24½, down 2½ for the day. December futures at 2.39½, high, low at 37, settlement price a half above that at $2.37½ a bushel for the December corn. Down 2½ for the new crop. March contract at 2.47¼, high, low at 2.45¼. Settlement price there at 2.46¼. They were down a penny and a half. In the May futures, a 2.53 high, low at 2.51¼. Settlement at 2.52 even. They were down 1 cent for the day for the May contract in the corn pit. July futures next year, 2.57 the high, the low at 55. Settlement price at $2.55¾ a bushel for the July, down a penny and a quarter. And next year's September contract, 55¼ the high, the low at 54. Settled on that low at $2.54 a bushel for the September corn 2006, down a penny and a quarter for the day. September oats, 1.59¾ the high. Low at 156, settlement price at 157¼, down 3/4. December futures 3/4 lower as well, 168 the high, the low at 164¼, and a settlement price at 166, down 3/4 for the day. August contract in the bean pit now, $6.75½ the high, low at 668½, settlement price at $6.71¼, and they were up a penny and a quarter for the day. September futures 680 the high, the low at 671½, settlement price at 675½, up a quarter. In November beans, 687½, the high, the low at 679. Settlement price at 682½, up one for the day. January soybeans, 691, the high, the low at 83. Settlement price at $6.87½, up 1½. And the March contract, 688½, the high, the low at 680½. Settlement price at $6.85, up two. And the May contract, to 681½, the high, the low at 674. settlement price at $6.79, and they were up 4 cents in the May beans for the day. August bean meal now, $2.13.20 the high, the low at $2.10.70. Settlement price at $2.12.60. They were up 180. September futures at $2.12 high, low at $2.09.20, and a settlement price at $211.10. They were up 180 for the day as well. August bean oil, $24.33 the high, the low at $24.05. Settlement price there at $24.15 for the day, and they were down 15 cents. And the September bean oil, $24.40 the high, the low at $24.11. Settlement price at $24.21. And they were down 19 at 6 after the hour. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker about the marketplace. Check in and see if he thinks beans will go back up above $7.07 in my rain gauge before I walked out the door this morning in Mahomet. And we'll find more about the weather with Peter Levitt during the closing market report 2 today. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Lean hogs were mixed today. Everything else finished lower at the Merc. August feeder cattle, 109.80 the high, the low 109 even, the settlement 109.42 and a half, that down 60. September 108.85 the high, 107.75 the low, 107.85 the settlement, that down $1. October 108.15 the high, the low 107.05 the settlement 107.25, that down 110. August live cattle, 82 even the high, 80.50 the low, 80.62 and a half the settlement, that down 167 and a half. October 83.15 the high, 81.65 the low, the settlement 81.72 and a half, that down 165. August lean hog, 69.60 the high, the low 69.07 and a half, the settlement 69.40, that down 32 and a half. October 60.30 the high, 59.50 the low, 60.22 and a half, the settlement, that up 15. December lean hogs, 58.45 the high, 57.55 the low, the settlement 58.32 and a half, that finished up 30. February lean hogs, 60 even the high, 59.40 the low, 59.90 the settlement, that down 2.5. In August, pork bellies were down $2 today. The high, 71.75 the low, and the settlement today, 69.90. The Dow is off 80 points at 10,618. The NASDAQ down 23 at 21.94. And the S&P 500, 8 lower at 12.37.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Webmaster Bob from Santa Clara, California, wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, why are so many computer magazines overly colorful, over-designed, and impossible to read?
They're masking a lack of inner substance with a great deal of packaging. Since computers are perceived to be an emerging technology, there's a great deal of deliberate pandering to the audience that corporate squares believe are the people at the cutting edge of the movement. Hence the overuse of the word cool, the retro psychedelia.